When he was 50, Jesse Browner says he looked up and realized the life he was leading with a family mortgage and a full-time job in international civil service wasn't the one he wanted. The one he did want, the bohemian, responsibility-free life of an author, had passed him by. So he began to ask the questions we all ask ourselves. How did this happen? How did I make the right choices? Am I fulfilled? His new memoir, How Did I Get Here? Making Peace with the Road Not Taken, is an exploration of all those questions that keep us up at night. It's published by Harper Wave, and I'm very pleased to welcome Jesse back to our show today. Hello.
I'm very happy to be here again.
Well, you've been here, this is your third time.
That's right.
And you were here a fairly long time ago to talk about your first published book. So you're a published author. You've published quite a bit over the years. What's the problem?
It's certainly not a problem with writing. I've always been able to figure out a way to write exactly as I wanted. As a matter of fact, having a full-time job has been liberating in one sense because, unlike so many of my peers who have to struggle to make an alternate living because it's almost impossible to make a living as a literary novelist, I've never had to worry about that. That was my original purpose.
Although most of them wind up teaching in universities and such, you wound up at the UN?
By a series of circumstances that could only be called fortuitous, I met a guy at a party. He said, oh, they're always looking for freelancers there. I took an informal exam. I worked freelance, and then they offered a competitive international exam, and since I had had so much experience already, I was able to pass the exam. And a job at the UN for a linguist is not something that you pass up readily, and I didn't, and I've been there ever since.
Well, it actually helps you with your writing chops, I'd imagine.
Well, to a certain extent it does, because it's all about concision and being terse and finding the right word. As a literary translator, that's also incredibly helpful.
You begin your memoir with the story of A.D. Harvey. Who is he, and why is he important to your story?
Well, A.D. Harvey is a British academic who was caught in a literary scandal a few years ago when it was discovered that he had invented a whole community of academics who were writing about one another, but especially writing about him and praising him highly. He is a man who calls himself a failed academic rather than an independent academic. He claims to have applied for something like 700 or 800 jobs and have been turned down for all of them, which he attributes to pettiness and small-mindedness and envy. And that is sort of why he is a really good portal into the issues that I address in the book.
You quote his question, how does the life we live relate to the lives we might have lived or ought to have lived? And that must have been, to some degree, an inspiration for this.
That's exactly
memoir.
True. That's exactly where I got into it.
But there's also the matter of the envy. And envy permeates this book. I would have thought, again, with your career, although you describe yourself as a B-list writer, there are a lot of people who might envy you.
It's possible. The literary life by itself, regardless of whether you have to do something else to earn a living, is not always enviable. You start out as a young person thinking that it's filled with glory and the possibilities of fame. You get disabused of that very quickly. So sitting in a room by yourself for hours on end is not necessarily enviable, except that for most of us, that's the part of our life that is not work.
I suspect that many of my listeners have asked themselves, have I lived the life I intended, or similar questions. So if you'd like to join in the conversation, our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMIC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate. The number again, 212-433-9692. We opened with the Talking Heads, How Did I Get Here? You obviously took your title from that. Were you listening to that song while you were writing the book?
No, as a matter of fact, I resisted that title for a long time. I have probably the most wonderful publisher in New York City. Her name is Karen Rinaldi, and she was trying to sell me on that for about a year until it suddenly dawned on me that it was the perfect title for the book. The song itself encapsulates everything that the book is about.
Actually, the title of the song is Once in a Lifetime.
That's right.
But are you really asking the question, was I successful? Have I had a successful life?
No, not at all. I'm asking, have I lived the life I intended to live? And how do I know if I've lived that life? It's very difficult to know because it requires, everybody tells you how important it is to be true to yourself, but nobody tells you how to do it. And everybody has to do it by themselves. And it's often a lifetime's project to understand your own motivations.
You mentioned the film Troy, or in this case, Brad Pitt playing Achilles in that movie, in which he said, "When I die, they will remember my name." Why do you think that's so important to some people and totally irrelevant to others?
You know, I really don't know. It's a question that I ask myself again and again in the book. Why is it important for me to be known by strangers when I'm surrounded by people who love me? That's a question I think that, you know, actors probably ask themselves more than writers do. But nevertheless, the idea of pretending that fame is completely irrelevant to the artistic momentum, it's false, I think.
Movie actors are going to be recognized on the street and at parties, whatever. Writers and talk show hosts are not going to be recognized unless people have either read you or listened to their show.
Well, I recognize you. And my picture is on every book.
Yeah.
I do, of course. It's much more about being recognized by your peers, I think, than by being recognized by the public at large. But, of course, you don't write in a vacuum. I'm writing for someone. If I was only writing for myself, I'd write a diary. And so it's not so much wanting to be famous as wanting the largest number of people possible to read my books.
You do write that. You sometimes get envious reading writers' obituaries in the New York Times.
That's right.
and that you get jealous of your old self.
Well, it's true. You know, there are times when for one reason or another, I'm forced to look through my old work, and sometimes I'm very surprised at how good it can be on occasions, and I'm surprised that I was ever able to write something like that because, you know, the project is always about being better than you have been in the past.
Well, I mentioned that you are a published novelist, essayist, translator. Your work has appeared in many different publications, including a bunch of food publications, and you've been published all over the world.
Well,
and that your obituary will make all of those points.
Well, if I have an obituary. The thing is, I think that this issue of envy is probably overblown. It's where I started from. This book came out of an essay that I wrote for Poets and Writers magazine. And the essay was about the British writer Jeff Dyer. I had just read a biography of him, or rather an article about him, in which he claimed to live his life without doing any work. His work was his life was his work, and nobody could tell him what to do. And that struck me as not only something that was enviable, but how did Jeff Dyer live my life, the life that I had always wanted to live as a young man?
It's something that happens. It's a road not taken. We'll get to that in a moment as well. But at a certain point, you decide to not take that job or not write that thing, and the rest of your life is affected by those decisions.
That's right. But sometimes...
So how did Jeff Dyer do it? Do you think he's...
He was single-minded.
Because he's a better writer?
It's possible. It's distinctly possible. He was also much more single-minded than I am. But more importantly than everything is the thrust of this book is to understand my own decisions. And I it took an entire book and, of course, 30 years for me to understand that, in fact, I have lived the life that I intended to lead. I just didn't know it back then.
Well, you're married. You have kids. Mm-hmm. Many people would consider that fulfilling in itself.
As do I. Absolutely. It was much more an issue of how does one understand the arc of one's life when it ends up being so very different from the way you imagined it when you were young and just starting out. It's not about having made mistakes necessarily. It's about understanding yourself through the decisions you've made.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. Anne from Teaneck, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. So I'm responding to the question that you had asked. You know, what does your life look like now compared to what you imagined it when you were younger? So I think often when we imagine, that's my GPS, you're on speaker. When we imagine our lives when we're younger, we're naive, and most of the time they don't come out that way because of the curveball that life throws us. So for me, I have four children, and two of them have special needs. So that has been the defining experience of my life and taken me places I never could have imagined and given me focus and made me truly humble.
And what had you thought your life was going to be like?
I guess I thought, that's a good question. I grew up on Long Island. I thought it was just going to be your, like, typical life. You know, get married, have kids, work. But this has been a, because of who my boys are, it has made me appreciate all of my children more, and it has been a most fulfilling journey.
Thank you so much for your call. Now, I should point out that when I was young, I wanted to be a serious painter, studied with some pretty great artists. But at a certain point, I realized that I wasn't as good as any of those people I had studied with. I was good, but not good enough by my own standards. And then went through a whole bunch of different jobs and wound up here. Well, I'm very happy that I have. But if you'd asked me at the age of 18 or 20 what I would be at this point in my life, I'd be a well-known artist.
Well, of course, in my case, the decisions that have led me here have not been dramatic decisions. There haven't been the kind of dramatic trauma that your caller describes. And I knew that going into writing the book, that I could not base it on my life, because after all, who really cares about the travails of a middle-class, mid-list literary novelist? So I expanded the book, and I write about people from all walks of life, famous people and less famous people, including my sister Nancy, who had her whole life as an actress mapped out until one day she was given a diagnosis of leukemia and 1 week to live. And when she recovered from that, she changed her entire life. So there's lots and lots of different ways in which lives can be diverted from the original intention.
My guest is Jesse Browner, who's written a memoir called How Did I Get Here? Making Peace with the Road Not Taken. It is published by Harper Wave. And we'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Jesse Browner, who's written a memoir called How Did I Get Here? And Making Peace with the Road Not Taken. It is published by Harper Wave. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Mike from Huntington, Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing, Leonard?
I'm well. What do you want to talk about?
Good. Yeah, I just wanted to, of course, the follow-up to that song, How Did I Get Here, Letting the Days Go By, is really exactly how we all end up where we are. But besides that, I just wanted to say that in my life, what I've found is my job is not something that I felt I wanted to define me. I had other interests. I'm a musician. I'm an athlete. I'm a family guy. Those are really my passions in life. I never had a passion for anything that I thought I would make a living out of, but I followed through on my passions because I had a decent job and a wonderful wife and family that allowed me to do those things. So that's what I wanted to share, basically, that my life is fulfilled because of my passions other than my job.
Now, Mike, as somebody who is a musician as well, did you have any ambitions to become famous when you got older?
Actually, I had the opportunity to become famous. Well, I shouldn't say become more successful as a musician, but I turned it down because I felt my family was more important, and I knew my family relationships would suffer by being on the road all the time. So I chose to keep the old 9-to-5 job or whatever I had been doing at the time, which also gave me more artistic freedom. I started another group that I was the leader of. I was allowed to do anything I wanted at any time. It was also very successful, and you know, I'm still able to travel a little with music and so forth, but it wasn't, I never had ambitions to be famous and have music be my living, so to speak, because I knew that it was a very difficult road to take, and I chose not to do that.
Thanks for calling us, Mike. One of the people you write about here is Franz Kafka, who we know mostly from the things that were published posthumously. He only published a few things during his life. In fact, didn't he ask Max Brod to burn all of his manuscripts?
Yes, he did. I mean, it's widely believed that he asked them to burn the manuscripts in full knowledge that he never would. And that's why he gave it to Max Brod. He could have given it to anybody who would have burned them.
Mm-hmm. But still, he wanted to go, if I remember correctly, wanted to go to Palestine and open a restaurant near the end of his life. He wasn't thinking, I want to be a famous writer.
That's right. I mean, this is a perfect example of asking the question, what if he had not died prematurely, his life was definitely on a track to move to Germany with his last lover and then ultimately to Palestine. There's no knowing what would have happened. However, all of those great books would still have remained written.
You divide your adult life into 5 distinct phases: ambition, love, work, fulfillment, and serenity. Are you in the serene phase now?
Is that what it is, serenity? I remembered it as wisdom, but no. That's the aspirational part of it.
How do you move from one phase to the next? Are there revelatory moments, or do you just find yourself
differently? This is all done in retrospect, and to be perfectly honest, it's a somewhat artificial construct that helped me structure the book in a sort of a linear way. We don't live that way, of course. We don't, but we can certainly look back at our lives and say this was the moment when I was a young man, when I had no attachments and my ambition was driving me. In my case, I fell in love and was married. That, of course, did not do anything to dampen my ambition as a writer.
But it may have stopped you from living the bohemian life that you'd also imagined.
Well, it did. But, you know, again, it's not a question of regret. It's a question of understanding, ultimately, that for the most part, we are free agents, whether we wish to recognize that or not. And those decisions are decisions we made. We may not always understand those decisions, but clearly we made them with some sort of future in mind.
Do you think that the bohemian life is different today than it was when you were younger? You imagine going to Paris and drinking, eating at the coffee, at the restaurants that Hemingway ate at. But who are the bohemians of today, the hipsters?
Well, I don't know. No, I don't think you can say that. Bohemianism, I talk in the book a lot about the bohemians of Paris in the early 19th century, who were sort of the real ancestors and progenitors of Bohemia. And they were people who stepped outside of society so that they could work without any kind of commercial pressure. And it was a very dangerous thing that they did, because in the 19th century, if you didn't have a job and you had no income, that meant you didn't have heat or hot water or food, and there was no social net to back you up. And they died by the thousands. In fact, Henri Murger, who wrote the kind of ur-book on Bohemia on which La Bohème was based and ultimately Rent, he died of illnesses that he had acquired as a young Bohemian. When I was a young, quote-unquote, Bohemian, there was no danger of any of that happening, even though we lived in on the Lower East Side in rat-infested tenements. We mostly had hot water and heat in the winters. We weren't running any risks. If we needed clothing, we could get them. We didn't have to burn our furniture for heat. And half of our friends were waiters. So it was a very different thing. Now, I don't know. I have two daughters, one who just graduated from college, and there's no Bohemian left in Manhattan, and barely any, I think, left in Brooklyn. It's just too expensive. You know, I paid $180 for my apartment on 12th Street 35 years ago. That just doesn't exist anymore. I don't know how they're going to do it.
Let's take another call. Lou from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I was thinking about this whole concept. I think everybody at one time in their lives questioned whether or not, you know, they arrived at where they want to be at, or where they thought they would be at. And I myself was in prison for a number of years, starting at a very young age. And, you know, obviously you have a lot of time to think, to learn, and to kind of hope for, you know, a better future and plan. And then I thought that I had everything kind of mapped out. And
well, you didn't plan to go to prison, did you?
No, definitely not. But
what did you think you were doing?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What did you think you were doing? What did you think you would be doing? How did you wind up in prison?
Well, I was 18. I made a series of poor decisions living in Long Island. And then I ended up starting at the age of 18, serving 19 years. Actually, I was released 3 years ago yesterday. And, you know, I'm still adjusting. So I spent a lot of time in prison trying to learn, did a lot of reading. I listened to your show every day, as a matter of fact. And I started singing. I got involved in a very unique piano program that was offered at Sullivan Correctional Facility at the time. And we began to offer recitals. So one of the inmates, his mother was playing violin with the ballet orchestra. And after a few of our recitals, we started to have guests from Lincoln Center come into the prison and offer recitals. So it was during this time that I started experimenting with my voice. I grew up playing cello, and I always admired opera, but I never tried singing it until this particular time. And one of the guests from the Lincoln Center thought, you know, that I had some raw talent, and they decided to try and locate a coach, which they did upstate. He's semi-retired, but he auditioned me and said, okay, I'll volunteer on a bi-weekly basis. And he came in, and we worked, we trained, I studied everything I could get my hands on. We weren't allowed to have CDs, so I had to, you know, catch whatever I could on the radio, old cassettes. And I vocalized every day. No matter what prison I was in, I always found a way to vocalize at least an hour a day in some room or, you know, a church.
And Lou, how's it worked out now? Do you have a career as a singer?
No, I don't. I'm struggling. I'm making just below, just above minimum wage, working hard. I vocalize still. I do perform at some local recitals. And, you know, everybody says, wow, I mean, you should be, you know, at least singing in the chorus at the Met. And I've tried to apply for the chorus position at the Met. And it's very hard to get auditions because, you know, I'm competing with I call them kids, but, you know, they're in their 20s and, you know, they have degrees from Juilliard and Manhattan. I don't have those degrees. I obviously, in prison, I wasn't able to accrue any real experience, which they're interested in.
Lou, good luck. I hope somebody's listening and thinking, well, maybe I should give that guy a chance.
Well, yeah, but there's one thing.
But you're facing the big problem that a lot of people face when they're suddenly in the mid-career ages and they're trying to establish themselves.
Right. But I wonder, in regard to what we're discussing, I sometimes wonder if we just all have a destiny and that the only free will we have is the power of thought. So we're going to go through an experience and that we're destined to go through that experience, but perhaps we have the power over how we perceive it.
Thank you for your call.
You know, I'd like to say, as a novelist, you have to always believe that character is destiny. So I have to agree with Lou. It's not a destiny that's imposed by the gods like the ancient Greeks, but we create, in a certain sense, our own destiny. I write about the British psychologist Adam Phillips, who says that we share our lives with the people we fail to become. And very often what happens, I think, is that we mistake ourselves for those people. We look in the mirror and we look at somebody we thought we were 30 years ago. And one of the great projects of our lives may be, especially as we reach a certain age, and this book is definitely about reaching a threshold where you can look at yourself, is that we have to learn to unsee ourselves. We have to learn to stop looking at ourselves with the eyes that we saw ourselves with 30 years ago. And hopefully somebody like Lou is in that process right now.
You've said that you first wrote this memoir totally. When you were first writing the memoir, you didn't see it as a self-help book. Do you see it to some degree as a self-help book now?
Well, I see it literally as a self-help book. It helped me. I wrote it to help myself. I was giving a reading just the other night, and after the reading, one of the participants asked me, "So, do you feel better?" And I had to say, "Yes, I do feel better." I did not write it necessarily to help other people, but it seems that if I as a novelist who doesn't necessarily share a great deal in common with most people, if I can help myself through this exercise, other people can.
You talk about Robert Frost's famous poem, "The Road Not Taken." I think Lou probably would think about that poem as well, and looking back over his life, most of us wonder about what would have happened if we had done that thing that night instead of the other thing that we chose to do.
That's right. I think everybody does. That was the impulse behind writing a book and also expanding the subject so that it wasn't just about artists. But what we always have to remember with that poem is that he says, "I took the road less traveled by, and that has made all the difference." He doesn't actually say that it's made a good difference. He never says that. In fact, the poem is called "The Road Not Traveled." He's not talking about the road that he did take. He's talking about the road that he didn't take. And we all suffer the consequences of our decisions, and we have to live by them. I'm afraid Lou probably suffered more than he needed to.
I want to sneak Mila in here. We don't have a lot of time, Mila. You get the last word. Mila from Livingston, New Jersey.
Yes. I always wanted to be a writer, and all my teachers predicted big writing future for me. And then around 25, I came to America from Russia, and I didn't speak any English, and that was the end of my writing career, as I thought. I became a physical therapist, but I was learning English because I didn't want to give up my dream, and now I'm over 50, and I just finished my first big novel in English, and I hope it will be published.
Well, it didn't hurt Nabokov to have English as a second language.
Or Joseph Conrad. Or Gary Steingart, for that matter.
So good luck, Mila.
Thank you so much.
Well done, Mila. Good luck.
And my great thanks to Jesse Browner, who, how many books so far?
This is my sixth.
The Everything Happens Today, probably the best known, although now we have How Did I Get Here, a memoir, Making Peace with the Road Not Taken. It is published by Harper Wave. It's been a pleasure having you back on our show.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.